Hey, everyone, we haven't done this before, but we had lots of stuff we wanted to share in this episode. So we decided to cut it into two parts, two shorter parts, so that you don't have one mammoth episode that you have to fit in. So listen to part one now, and part two will be out in a couple of weeks. And we hope you enjoy. Hey, and welcome to Product Journeys. I'm Fran Gleisner.
And I'm Lachlan Robertson. We're both product managers stumbling our way through our product journeys. We're out to meet amazing product people and learn a bit more about their skills and experiences.
And today we are talking to Adam Wright. Adam began his product journey as a leap from QA. He gained experience at Flux Federation building energy management software before heading to Xero. Then he had a brief stint at a digital conferencing startup before returning to Xero, and he's now at a Kiwi edtech company called Education Perfect. Adam has learned a ton along his journey, and he's seen the good, the bad, and the ugly, and learned a lot about operating in each of these environments. I was lucky enough to work with Adam for a short time, so I'm really stoked that he's joining us today. Adam, it's really nice to have you on the podcast. Welcome. We usually start with your product journey, so I'll hand over to you and you can set us off.
Sure. Thanks very much for having me, Fran, Lockie. I'm really excited to be here, and it has been a bit of a journey now I reflect on it. So I think I actually fell into technology as a whole pretty accidentally almost. So I started out when I was about 22, 23 in a business communications role, where really I was just responding to letters from customers of a large general insurer. And then a friend of mine was sort of handpicked to go and test this new system. You know, it was an internal system that we used, and they were making some changes to that. And he was picked to be a QA on that system. And I quickly saw that he seemed to be having much more enjoyment out of his new role and thought, that sounds pretty good to me as well. And I guess to be completely candid, the money on offer in technology was really attractive as well. It is one of the more highly paid sectors, so I was really keen to advance my career in that way as well. So after watching him go and smash this role for a couple of months, and it didn't seem too onerous and he was learning a ton, I asked if there was any way I could get into that as well. And I was lucky enough, and I think this is a bit of a theme that I'm going to return to a couple of times, is that while hard work and merit are absolutely important, luck, I think, plays a massive part in some of the opportunities you are or aren't offered. So I was lucky enough that the person that was running that small team of people, I guess, QAing this large organizational change, one, needed to grow their team, and two, was willing to take a punt on people without experience. That was my introduction to technology. So I started as a QA, very manual, going through and just executing test cases and writing very basic test plans. And I spent a long time doing that, and I probably hit a wall when I needed to start to learn to code, which I did not to enjoy. Naturally, my brain isn't wired to work that way. So I learned a little bit of JavaScript to write some very, very basic test scripts, and then quickly decided I think I need to look at getting out of QA, getting out of testing. And around this time, our organization was being introduced to Agile. I can't remember what year this would have been. I've been in that role for 7 years, I think, at the time. So it certainly, you know, it was a good tour of duty. And we started to hear about these new roles like product owner and scrum master. And these were all brand new concepts to me, to many in our organization. This was in New Zealand, of course. So it was probably old news for the Bay Area and some of these big tech hubs. But for us, it was all new. And we had all these consultants come in from San Francisco to sell us the Agile dream. I chunted along for maybe another year in that role, but there were a couple of aspects of Agile that I was really interested in learning more on. One was the Agile coaching or Scrum mastering, and the other was product ownership. So long story short, the product ownership role at that company was kind of like wearing a hat. It wasn't an official role designation. So I put my hand up to wear that hat and be that link between the business and a technology team. It was pretty old school. Like, I now recognize this was really in no way Agile whatsoever, but it was my first taste of product ownership. I was the interface between some of those business requirements and large, they were really still waterfall style projects. And then our development team trying to move to this new way of developing in sort of 2 week sprints and releasing value iteratively. And so I kind of did that informally for a little bit and then started applying for roles. And again, I was really lucky, I think, that the head of product at Flux Federation decided to take a punt. And apparently I almost lost out on the role because I wore a suit to the second interview. And it wasn't that vibe at all. The large general insurer where I was and had been, even if you were not in the customer-facing role, you were still expected to dress business standard. So I'd wear a suit and tie just naturally to work every day. And I had to fit this interview into my work day. And so I wasn't going to roll up and then say, hey, can I nip to the toilets for 2 minutes to do a Superman-style costume change? I thought, presumably they know that I've got the ability to put on a pair of jeans and a T-shirt. But no, it was a bit of a deal breaker, which I guess was an introduction into how important culture can be in a company and how much they saw that as a risk, that I might be full of too many kind of old, stodgy corporate ideals and ideas. But no, they took a punt on me, and it was my first taste of actually having a designated product owner role. So I worked with one small dev team. I was lucky enough to be surrounded by lots of people I could learn from. In particular, there was a senior product owner who had done this in the Netherlands before and done this in London. And I felt just like really, really lucky again that I happened to have someone next to me who was well-versed in a lot of these methodologies, a lot of the product thinking, and I was able to lean on him pretty heavily to kind of find my craft, really. Like, before that, I think I was a glorified Jira jockey, just, oh yeah, the business wants this. I can write that in this piece of software, no problem. Yeah, I'll go to a ceremony and hold up my fingers and say, oh, yeah, I reckon it's a 5, even though I had absolutely no idea. So I was really going through the motions, I think. But as I started to work closely with this person who was vastly more experienced than me and be immersed into a culture of, I guess, a lot more true agility, that was probably where I was kind of made into like a product professional, and where I was able to actually set a good foundation to start building some skills. And I was at Flux for 2 years, progressed to a group product manager role there. This was a new role for them, so we were kind of finding our way as we went along. And again, I think that group product manager role was quite ceremonial. It didn't have direct people leadership involved in it, but it did involve sitting at the product level over a number of teams and trying to guide those teams together as a cohesive strategy. And then from there, we had some large organizational changes again. I thought, hey, that's a good time to go and look somewhere else. And then I found myself at Xero, which is a bit Kiwi institution. I was super excited about that. And again, I just felt that level up in terms of actual product practice. And I think every time I've made a move, or most times I've made a move, it's really felt like a level up in product practice that I could learn from. And that's something that has been really important to me, that I kept developing and learning new ideas and learning what didn't work as well. And so Xero was kind of like product university for me, I guess. I think prior to that, my learning would have been the classic hockey stick graph, like always going up. And over time at Xero, it shot up, but I think it probably started to even out a little bit. So still learning, but at a much slower rate than I had been before. After my time at Xero, I went to a startup and I was the first product hire, and that was a real baptism of fire. But after a while, I quit that job because it just wasn't worth the mental load and the mental tax on me. It was an itch I'd always wanted to scratch, being at a startup. I'm glad I did. I don't regret it, but I wouldn't be hurrying back. And then I took some time out and spent 5 months on my couch watching Drive to Survive and playing PlayStation, which was awesome. It was really good for me. It was a good reset. My first 3 years at Xero were really hardcore. It was probably the hardest I'd ever worked, but the most rewarded I've ever felt as well. And I probably was in need of some rest and mental reset from that anyway. So jumping straight into a startup was probably a little bit of a silly move in some ways. Then not long after that, Xero came calling again. An opportunity had opened up. Went back to Xero in a group product manager role, which is Fran, where you and I worked together briefly. And yeah, after that, when Xero had its large restructure, my role was one of the at-risk roles, and I started looking around almost immediately. I just had a baby. I just bought a house. I'd just gotten engaged. A lot of things that I needed a level set kind of foundation for, and I really didn't have a huge appetite for career risk at that point. So I was lucky enough that a recruiter for my current workplace contacted me on LinkedIn. And I had 3 offers come in. I kind of had to choose between optimizing for one place. I was optimizing for money if I'd taken that role. One place I would have been optimizing for role. So the actual title would have been quite a prestigious title. And the place I ended up going to, I think I've optimized for environment, which after weighing everything up, environment was the single most important thing for me, having probably made some moves for the money and for the role title in the past. I felt like those things were no longer as important to me. And I feel like I'm in a really, really good, healthy environment where I feel like I'm starting to, you know, the hockey stick graph might be coming back a little bit in terms of my learning. It's much smaller than Xero where I am now. And that allows you a little bit more freedom and a little bit more rapidity of decision-making as well. So that's been my journey to date.
It's good. I think the last point that you landed on, then the interesting contrast between the money, the title, and then perhaps the environment or maybe the culture that you alluded to before. Do you think that that's something that, having gone through all of those different decisions, has helped you then land on where you are today, or is it just a life stage thing?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I think there are times where you have to optimize for career growth and title, even if the environment's not ideal or even if the money's not ideal. You're planning for the longer term. And when you're early stage career, you don't have the luxury of being able to turn down too many roles either. So you might have to say, hey, I think this environment might be tough for me. It might not be the Marty Kagan platonic ideal, but it's going to get me a foot in the door. I am absolutely going to learn things, and it's not forever. I think that was something that I started to think about probably in my second or third year at Xero, is I started to get more confident in my own abilities and really feel that I had some value in product to add to organizations. And that gave me the confidence to be a little bit more both picky if I was looking around, but also to look around. I think there's a little bit of a stigma, and maybe this is a Kiwi thing as well, is that we feel almost like this weird, like, over loyal sense to our employers. And I do think it's good to, like, to what your employer can offer you and pay that back, but you pay it back with the quality of work that you do. You're selling your time and labor and skills to them in exchange for a salary. I've probably gotten a little bit too philosophical there, but anyway, my point is I think I grew in confidence and I was able to make those different optimizations, but early stage you might not. Yeah. And that's something I'd probably advise people, is that don't be too picky because you can't afford to be, but you will grow into that. That does come with time and experiences. You get more confidence and you gain more skill. And so then you kind of earn that right to be a bit more picky, and also just the confidence within yourself.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love also that challenge as well to Kiwi people, PMs, to think about. The role title thing really fascinates me. You've had a lot of different product role titles, from product manager to group product manager to senior PM. And I was thinking, when you were saying the decision on the role title, that's not as straight up as just the title of the role, right? It must be also what the responsibilities that come with that role. How do you work out what that role actually looks like? And when you look at a title, like, how does that link back to the role itself?
Yeah, I think this is something that took me a while to learn. And previously, if you'd asked me that maybe 5 years ago, I would have said, well, you never really know until you're in it. And there is some truth to that. But I think I've learned how to interview for roles now that give me a much better idea, a much clearer idea of what that role is actually going to look like day to day. Because every employer will put their best foot forward. And I think one thing I've learned is that employers, when they're hiring, they almost hire to what they aspire to be rather than the reality of what that role looks like. And some stuff can look amazing, but the truth can be very, very different, right? And I get why companies do this, because that's what they want to be and that's what they see themselves as. A classic one is, you'll see product roles where we are an empowered team, or our product management truly own and drive product decisions. And then you land on the ground and you're like, no, this isn't actually happened. This is classic top-down management where I'm being told to execute a project. And so I think by interviewing more, and I guess, again, just having a little bit more confidence that if this role doesn't work out, A, it probably wasn't meant to be, and B, there'll be other opportunities, I've learned how to interview in a way that I can cut to the quick of a little bit more about what the role actually might look like. I think maybe a couple of questions that I wouldn't have even fathomed asking early in my career would be asking something like a product person who's doing the hiring, what was the last thing you or your team said no to? What was the last strategic decision that you challenged? How did that challenge work out? Things like that, I wouldn't have, you know, considered asking those questions early on. And there's probably a bunch of questions like that. But asking those questions can kind of make people take a step back and really think about, well, have we actually said no to anything? You know, it's something that, to be an empowered team, you need to also be empowered to say no. So understanding when they said no, what to, and how that played out can give you a lot of actual information. Obviously, people can just lie, but I think most people are pretty authentic and genuine in an interview situation, and particularly in group situations, you can start to build a much clearer picture of what it might be like to actually work for that organization by asking some really targeted questions.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I'm also thinking back to your comments around the transition to agile, like the product owner, but perhaps it's disguised in a wider waterfall situation as well. Questions like that would help work out, are they actually doing product?
Yeah, tell me how your team defines a roadmap item. Things like that. Like when you actually ask about the nuts and bolts, which maybe in the past I felt a little bit reticent to, because it felt a bit like oh gosh, should I really be asking them that at this stage? Absolutely you should, because you need to know that when you make the leap of faith to actually sign a contract and go and work at this place every day, that it's going to be an environment that, one, you're happy in, and two, you can grow in. And I don't know if this is a spicy take or not, but I think a lot of product management and product owner roles that are advertised are actually delivery manager roles. They want someone to crack the whip and execute a pre-plan. And you've got to be able to figure that out in the interview stage. Otherwise, you're going to get a nasty shock when you sign the deal.
Absolutely. Great spicy take. I'm going to go back. I love the culture aspect of it. I would agree if I'm going to choose a place as well. The environment's big. And going back to that role that you went into where you had that senior person next to you learning your craft, you said, how important do you think that is going into a role early to have somebody there who you're going to learn from who knows the stuff really well? Do you think that has been the starting point for how you've learned so much in product? And what do you do if you don't have that?
If it's not critical, it's pretty close. You've got to have someone that you can learn off, particularly early career. Otherwise, and this isn't a bad thing, but you'll be learning yourself. But without that depth of experience, you don't know if you're learning in the right direction. You might be learning kind of utopian ideals, or you might be learning outdated things, or you might be learning by trial and error, which, whilst it may get you there, it's just a really expensive way to learn, and it'll involve a lot of pain and making a lot of mistakes. And you're still going to make mistakes, for sure. And I think that's healthy and good. Failure is a part of growth, right? That's where I've probably learned some of my more valuable lessons. But I think being able to be close to someone and observing how they operate under different scenarios, you learn a lot by osmosis. So for example, I learned a lot about how this person dealt with pressure from senior stakeholders. I learned a lot about how this person dealt with contractual obligations that seemed like pie in the sky, and how to actually go and respectfully challenge those things. And I also learned how to disagree and commit. And some of those things you need to be upfront and observing to learn. There are just some skills that are very hard to learn from a book or a website or a blog or a podcast. But I think if you don't have that, you really do have to fall back on those default things. There's a lot of good writing out there. Find a product person whose ideas seem to resonate with you. I would always go for the sniper approach rather than the scattergun. Don't follow everyone and try and apply everything to everything. But I think whenever I've done self-directed learning, or whenever I felt like I wasn't getting great learning opportunities on the job, the most important thing for me, or the biggest payoff I felt, was when I've tried to apply things in context rather than read a blog, post about it at work. Hey, everyone, should we try this new thing I read about? I really haven't seen great success with that working. But what I have seen is building up an idea bank, or building up a toolkit, and then being able to apply that in your context, because not everything is applicable to every situation. Even some of those really popular priority frameworks like Moscow, cost of delay, RICE, if you just fall back on those every single time, you're probably limiting your own learning, and you're limiting your team's opportunity to ask different types of questions as well. So having a rich bank of stuff to draw on is really good, but you're only ever drawing on, you know, small things over time, and you just get better and better, I think, at applying it to the right context. And hey, if you mess it up, you mess it up. That's okay. But self-directed learning is your only option unless you've got someone to learn from. So having a mentor, either inside your company or outside, going and finding someone to talk with is just super important. It's worth the time. It's worth that uncomfortable first stage where you're kind of being quite vulnerable and saying, hey, I don't know a lot about this thing. I'd love to learn from you.
Yeah. And what I'm hearing there is the actual act of doing the thing, as opposed to just reading in a book, being really important as well. One of the things that I guess I'm interested in is perhaps progressing through the individual contributor role. Once you've built your skills in the product craft, the next progression that a lot of people fall into is doing that people management, the group management, this higher level role. Is that again something that you'd look for mentors and people to guide you and help grow those skills, or does the same process apply?
I think it absolutely can. Again, though, I think one of the good things about this is we all have managers and we all have bosses. So one of the key philosophies I've tried to apply is observing my managers that I really liked working for and trying to repeat the things they did that I enjoyed. Where I've been given opportunity, where someone's taken a punt on me, where I've been given leverage to make a mistake, I've tried to apply that in my own people management. I think it's super valuable. I think sometimes what I've observed is people trying to do textbook management, which is maybe less enjoyable for their direct reports, and almost treat people management like a box ticking exercise. But people management is not a product skill. any discipline that has people management, it's less about the discipline and how well you can relate to other human beings and really understanding what motivates them, what's important to them, how does this person work best. So understanding people as people is often not really related to your discipline. A lot of the people management that I do day to day, yes, I think it's great to be able to coach in context. So I can coach my product reports in product, but 90% of it isn't that, if that makes sense. 90% of it is understanding how they work, what motivates them, and what's important to them. What do they want to do? I remember being almost forced down the route of people management and feeling pretty scared by that and not enjoying it when I first did it. Like, I thought, oh my God, I suck at this. I'm really bad. I don't want to be a people manager, but it is the only way to progress. I think that's really common as well. People think the only way to progress in a role is to become a people manager, but it's really not. I think tech is changing and tech is now looking at other avenues for people who don't want to be people managers to progress and become a superstar individual contributor or a wider strategic thinker that influences without direct reports. And that's fantastic, because I think we've been missing out on a lot of people that have got a lot to offer by saying you're either a people manager or you're stuck.
That's great. I completely agree as well. I think it's awesome that that principal product manager role type is coming out. Thanks for listening to part one. Tune in for part two of Adam's episode and our learnings in a couple of weeks.